Hello, my name is Lily Chaudhry, and you're listening to Happiness Now, Secrets to Success from the East and West. Our talks are based on the works of Qasim Ali Shah. He's a renowned motivational speaker and trainer from Lahore, Pakistan. And thanks for tuning in. Benjamin Franklin famously said, "In this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes." Yet most of us never really think about death. And if the thought does ever cross our path, we quickly dismiss it and don't pay much mind to it. But how would our lives change if we did have our death in mind? Qasim Ali Shah says that death gives meaning to life. So how do the lives of those who fully acknowledge the reality of death differ from those who don't? And that's the topic of this episode. We'll talk about the transient nature of life, how death can help us live, and some real-life, modern-day stories of people who have lived while remembering death. First, I want to start by saying I don't by any means want this to be a depressing or morbid talk. I want us to realize that by understanding that we have a limited time on Earth, we can really start to live, to make the most out of our time here. So we all know that we have a finite amount of time. We all know that life is transient, meaning temporary, fleeting, passing. In a new 2017 report, the U.S. life expectancy is now 79 years old. The U.K. is 80. Pakistan is about 68. And South Africa is only about 50. Wow. So think of an ice cube out of the freezer. It's melting. There's no stopping it. Well, I'm sure you get the point. Life is just passing us by, but many of us just don't realize it. And the realization of life's transiency is therefore a blessing. In ancient Egypt, the pharaohs had no concept of the transient nature of this life. They thought once they died, their life continued in much the same way as on Earth. So they'd be buried with all their worldly possessions, thinking it would help them after death. Some of the different pharaohs' tombs included things like food, wall paintings, perfume and jewelry, games and weapons, and even boats and chariots. And the body of the pharaoh would be in a sarcophagus, which is like an ancient tomb. King Tutankhamun's body was in a solid gold coffin with a gold death mask, and the coffin was put inside a red quartz sarcophagus, and this was placed inside four gold shrines, each bigger than the last. And maybe the only good thing about these treasures is that they now can be a lesson for all of us on what's really important in life. I want to share a story of a man named Richard Tao. On November 24, 2011, Dr. Richard Tao, a successful cosmetic surgeon, gave a speech to a room full of graduate students. And I'm going to share what he said in his own words, but I've just had to shorten it a tiny bit. "Hi, good morning to all of you. My voice is a bit coarse from the chemotherapy, so please bear with me. I thought I'll just introduce myself. My name is Richard. I'll just begin to say that I'm a typical product of today's society. So I'm a typical product of what the media portrays. From young, I've always been under the influence and impression that to be happy is to be successful, and to be successful is to be wealthy. So I led my life according to this motto. Coming from a poor family back in those days, I was highly competitive, whether in sports, studies, or leadership. I wanted it all. But at the end of the day, it's still about money. So in my recent last years, I was a trainee in ophthalmology, but I was getting impatient because I had friends of mine who were going into private practice making tons of money. And there I was stuck in a traineeship. So I said, enough, it's getting too long. At that time, there was a surge in proteges of aesthetic medicine. I'm sure you're aware aesthetic medicine has peaked over the last few years, and I saw good money in it. So much so that I said, forget about ophthalmology, I'm going to do aesthetic medicine. So that's what I did. The truth is nobody makes heroes out of the average GP in the neighborhood. They don't. They make heroes out of rich celebrities, politicians, rich and famous people. So I wanted to be one of these. I dived straight into aesthetic medicine. People weren't willing to pay when I was doing locum back in those days. Anything more than $30, they would complain and say, oh, this doctor is very expensive. They made noise and they weren't happy. But the same people were willing to pay $10,000 for a liposuction. So I said, well, let's stop healing the sick. I'm going to become a beautician, a medically trained beautician. And that's what I did. Liposuction, breast augmentation, eyelid surgeries, you name it. We do it. It was very good money. My clinic, when we started off, waiting time was about a week. Then a month, became 2 months, became 3 months. There was so much demand that people were literally queuing up to have aesthetic work done on them. Vain women equals easy life. So the new clinic grew. I was so overwhelmed from one doctor, I employed two, then three, then four doctors and carried on. Nothing is ever enough. I wanted more and more and more. So things were doing well. I'm there. My time has arrived. Around some time in February last year, I said, okay, I have so much spare cash, it's time to get my first Ferrari. So there I was, getting ready for the deposit. Okay, there comes my first Ferrari. I was looking for land to share with some of my friends. I have a banker friend who makes $5 million a year, so I thought, come, let's get together, let's buy some land and build our houses. I was at my prime, getting ready to enjoy. At the same time, my friend Danny had a revival. They were going back to church, some of my closest friends. They told me, Richard, come, join us, come back to church. I went to church for a while, but after some time I got tired. After all, I had achieved all of these things without God today, so who needs God? I myself can achieve anything I want. In my arrogance, I told them, you know what, you go tell your pastor to change your sermon to 2 p.m. and I'll consider coming to church. Such arrogance. And I said one statement in addition to that. I told Danny and my friends, if God really wanted me to come back to church, he'll give me a sign. And lo and behold, 3 weeks later, I was back at church. On March 11th of 2011, out of the blue, I was still running around because I'm a gym freak and I always go to the gym training, running, swimming 6 days a week. I had some backache and that's all I had, but it was persistent. So I went in for an MRI to exclude a prolapsed disc. And the day before I had my scan, I was still in the gym, lifting weights, doing my squats. And the very next day, they found that half my spine had bone marrow replacement. I said, sorry, what's that? And they diagnosed that I had stage 4 terminal lung cancer. And it had spread to my brain, half my spine, and the whole of my lungs. They were filled with tumors, my liver, adrenals. I said, this can't be. I was just in the gym last night. What's going on? I'm sure you know how it feels, though I'm not sure if you know how it feels. One moment I was there at the peak, the next day this news came and I was totally devastated. My whole world just turned upside down. So the next day I was still in a state of denial, still unable to accept what was going on. Just completed the biopsy and lying on the operating table. The nurses and doctors had told me to wait 15 minutes to do an x-ray. Suddenly I just heard an inner voice. And it was not like coming from outside, it was inside. This small inner voice that I had never felt before. And it said very specifically, it said, this has to happen to you at your prime because it's the only way you can understand. I said, whoa, where did that come from? You know, when you speak to yourself, you say, okay, what time should I leave this place? Where shall I have dinner? You speak from a first-person point of view. You don't say, where should you go after this? Whereas the voice that came spoke as a third party, it said, this has to happen to you at your prime, because this is the only way you can understand. At that time, my emotions just overwhelmed me, and I broke down and cried. Because I had been so proud of myself my whole life, I needed nobody else. I was gifted with things that I could do. Why do I need anybody else? I was just so full of myself that there was no other way I could have turned back to God. In fact, if I were diagnosed with stage 1 or 2, I would have been looking around busily for the best cardiothoracic surgeon to remove a section of the lobe, do a lobectomy, do preventative chemotherapy. The chances of it being cured is extremely high. So who needs God? But I had stage 4B. No man can help. Only God can. A series of events happened after that, but I wasn't sold after that because of the inner voice, like becoming a believer or prayers or anything like that. No, I wasn't. To me, it was just simply, maybe there was a voice, or maybe that was just me talking to myself. But I didn't buy the story. What happened next was that I was being prepared for chemotherapy. I started off with the whole brain radiation therapy first, which takes about 2 to 3 weeks. And in the meantime, they prepared me for chemotherapy and supplements. I continued meeting my oncologist, asking him, how long do I have? I asked, And he said, not more than 6 months. And I said, even with chemotherapy? He said, about 3 to 4 months. I couldn't grasp that. It was difficult for me to come to terms. And even as I went through radiotherapy, I was struggling every day, especially when I wake up, hoping that it's just a nightmare. When I wake up, it'll all be over. As I was struggling day after day, I went into depression, which is the typical denial depression that you go through. But for one reason, I don't know why, there was a specific day that I was supposed to meet my oncologist. And about 2 p.m. that day, I felt a sudden surge of peace, of comfort, and in fact, a little happiness. And it was just overwhelming for no rhyme or reason. It just came about 2 p.m. And as I was getting ready, dressing up to meet my oncologist, I WhatsApped all my friends and I said, bros, I just feel so good suddenly. I don't know why. It just came. And it was a few days or a few weeks after that that my friend Danny revealed to me that he fasted 2 days for me. And he was bargaining with God. And he fasted for 2 days and he had ended the fast at that exact same time, about 2 p.m. That was the surge of sensation that came to me for no rhyme or reason. And I didn't know he was fasting for me. And when he ended the fast, I felt that sensation. So, whoa, things are getting a bit too coincidental. I was starting to buy a bit of the story. But still, I wasn't sold. As days passed, I completed my radiotherapy, about 2 weeks plus, getting ready for chemo, and so they let me rest for a few days. You see, lung cancer has the highest mortality rate. If you add up breast, colon cancer, and prostate cancer, if you add up the mortality rate of all three, it still doesn't add up to lung cancer. Simply because you understand you can remove the prostate, you can remove the colon, the breast, but you cannot remove your lungs. Literally, I had it in both lungs, tens of thousands of tumors. And that's why the oncologist told me, even with chemo, at most 3 to 4 months. Well, the guys prayed for me and the tumor markers started to come down. 90% of the tumors were wiped out and the tumor markers came down to more than 90% over the next few months. At that point, I said, well, it's to be expected, isn't it? The medicine is good. I'm still not buying the story. But still, you know, once you have the clinical knowledge, you know the statistics, 1 year survival, 2 year survival, having all this knowledge is not a good thing. Because you live with the knowledge that even with all this, the cancer cells are so unstable. They keep mutating. They will overcome and become resistant to the drugs, and eventually you're going to run out of medication. So living with this knowledge is a huge mental struggle. And one of those days, I was there in bed, struggling in the afternoon, asking God, why? Why do I have to go through this suffering? Why do I have to endure this hardship, this struggle? Why me? As I fell asleep, in my dreamy state, a vision came to me that said Hebrews 12:7-8. Now, mind you, at this time, I had not read the Bible. I have no clue what Hebrews is. I didn't even know how many chapters there are. Totally clueless. I didn't think too much of it. I just continued sleeping. Then I woke up and said, well, what's there to lose? I'll just check it out. So Hebrews 12:7-8 says, endure hardship as discipline, as God is treating you as his children. I think God answered me directly. As I was there sleeping, struggling with it, asking God, why do I have to suffer with this? And God says, endure hardship as discipline as God is treating you as his child. So at this point, I was sold. I said, you win, you win. Okay, I was convinced. And from that day onwards, I started believing in God. And the last time I heard that inner voice was the end of April. And that inner voice, same thing in the afternoon, I was sleeping. This time I wasn't struggling. I was just going to sleep. In a dreamy state, I just heard him say, help others in hardship. And it was more like a command rather than a statement. And that's when I embarked on this journey, helping others in hardship. And also over the last few months, I started to understand what this true joy is about. In the past, I thought true joy is about pursuing wealth. In my deathbed, I found no joy whatsoever with my objects. My Ferrari, thinking of the land I was going to buy to build my bungalow, having a successful business, etc. It brought me zero comfort, zero joy, nothing at all. Do you think I can hold on to this piece of metal and it's going to give me true joy? No, it's not going to happen. True joy comes from interaction with other people. And at a lot of times, it's a short-term pride, the past. When you pursue your wealth, Chinese New Year is the best time to do it. Drive my Ferrari, show off to my relatives, show off to my friends, do my rounds, and then you thought that was true joy. You really think that those guys who sold you that Ferrari, they share your joy with you? And your relatives, wow, do they share this joy with you? In truth, what you've done is just to elicit envy, jealousy, and even hatred. They're not sharing the joy with you. And what I have is that short-term pride, that wow, I have something that you don't have. And I thought that was joy. So what we basically have is short-term pride at the expense of somebody else. And I found no joy at all on my deathbed thinking of my Ferrari to hold on to it. To share your sorrow, to share your happiness, that is true joy. And you know what makes you smile? The true joy that comes from helping others in hardship. Because I've gone through this. I know what hardship entails. In fact, there's some cancer patients who tell me a lot of times, people come up to them and say, stay positive, stay positive. But you come in my shoes and you try to stay positive. You don't know what you're talking about. But now I have the license. So I've been going out and meeting other fellow cancer patients to share it with them, to encourage them. And I know because I've been through it, and it's easier for me to talk to them. And most importantly, I think true joy comes from knowing God. Not knowing about God. I mean, you can read the Bible and know about God, but really knowing God personally, getting a relationship with God. I think that's the most important, and that's what I've learned. So if I were to sum it up, I'd say that the earlier we sort out our priorities in life, the better it is. Don't be like me. I had no other way. I had to learn it through the hard way. I had to come back to God to thank Him for this opportunity. And there's a few things that I've learned through this. Number one, trust in the Lord your God with all your heart. This is so important. Number two is to love and serve others, not just ourselves. There's nothing wrong with being rich or wealthy, but the trouble is, a lot of us can't handle it. The more we have, the more we want. I've gone through it. The deeper the hole we dig, the more we get sucked into it. So much so that we worship wealth and lose focus. Instead of worshiping God, we worship wealth. And it's just a human instinct. We are all professionals, and we're going to private practice. We start to build up our wealth inevitably. So my thoughts are, when you start to build up wealth and when the opportunity comes, do remember that all these things don't belong to us. We don't really own it or have rights to this wealth. It's actually God's gift to us. Okay, so that was Dr. Tao's speech. Again, I have abridged it a bit, but I've included most of it. Dr. Richard Tao died in Singapore on October 18th, 2012, less than a year after he gave the speech. I think the lessons he said that he learned, number one, to trust God, and number two, to love and serve others, is something that we can take as valuable pieces of advice. And I feel we're lucky to have this wisdom from the late Dr. Tao. This story really hit home because, as I've mentioned before, my husband is currently in a medical residency program doing his training, and he regularly does 16-hour shifts. In fact, just today, I had a big dinner at my house. I had my parents over, cousin, sister, and her family, but my husband was missing most of it because he finished up his 15-hour shift and got home at 9 o'clock. But me and him have spoken about the fact that working this hard at the expense of our time, him doing backbreaking intense work at the hospital, and me alone with our three kids most of the time and with a full-time job is really not worth it if it was just for the benefit of our own family. The cost is just too great to just serve a few people. And I think that's the case for most of us. We work so hard to learn and earn that the purpose should be greater than just caring for a few people. Luckily, my husband's got a good head on his shoulders, and God willing, he's hoping to help people in developing countries with the skills that he's learning. You know, many of us have a lot of noble intentions and goals in life, but we're just not motivated enough to actually start doing anything about them. We say things to ourselves like, oh, I got plenty of time, I'll start in 5 years, or I'll do something when the kids are grown up. That's one of mine. Or I'll start serving humanity once I get rich. But the realization of death, really remembering death often, can change a person's life. And this is what is meant by death gives meaning to life. Qasim Ali Shah says that what he calls his own deathbed theory is basically a concept that says if a person thinks he only has a short time to live, he will start to change his life drastically. Envisioning death does not mean, however, we live in fear. I mean, remembering death shouldn't be so terrifying that we're frozen in fear. In fact, really, it's those of us who are living purposelessly that are really afraid of dying. Because those who are on God's mission know that they'll only die after they've accomplished something. That death will be God's call, that the person has done his duty on earth. It's the same way when a person is really prepared for his final exams. You know, he's been preparing and he's ready for it. Well, death is like that. Life is like his days and nights as a student, working hard, studying to perform well on his exam. And if he's prepared well, he's not afraid of the exam. But for the person who does nothing to prepare for the exam, well, he inevitably dreads it. So when we acknowledge death, remember death in our lives, Gautam Ali Shah notes that we may start to see these four positive changes. Number one, we start living life to the fullest. We stop wasting time and energy, and we use it carefully, meaningfully. Number two, we'll stop complaining. We'll become grateful for all the blessings that we have, like our health, food, safety, family, friends. You know, the Prophet Muhammad once said, "Whoever amongst you wakes up with three things, safety and security, a healthy body, and food for the day, it's as if though he were given the entire world." And I try to remember this often because truly many of us have these things and we really have the world. Okay, number three, we'll become more forgiving. Things people say or do will seem small in the larger scheme of things. Number four, we'll think of adding value to other people's lives. When we realize and we truly believe in death and know that we're not going to take our wealth with us, we're happy to share it. And in this next story I'm going to relate, I think it really exemplifies all of these changes. It's the story of a man named Ali Banat, and I think it's a remarkable and inspirational story. Ali Banat was born and raised in Sydney, Australia. He was born in a well-to-do household, but he started a few businesses on his own in his 20s. And by the time he was 30 years old, he was a self-made millionaire. His shoes would cost $2,000. He had diamond bracelets costing $60,000. He had luxury cars. One of them was a Ferrari Spider costing him $600,000. So this gives you an idea of his wealth and how he liked to spend it. But in 2015, Banat was diagnosed again with stage 4 cancer. Just like Dr. Teo. But I believe this was leukemia. And the doctor said he had 7 months to live. When he found this out, Banat immediately wanted to change his life and dedicate it to doing something for others. He realized that when he dies, all of his wealth will remain except for that which he spent on others. These would be his good deeds. And this is a concept from his faith that whatever good or bad that he does, he'll see the reward or punishment for it in the afterlife. And I think all major religions of the world also teach a similar concept. Banat said, "It all started when I was at the cemetery where a fellow patient that had cancer had passed away. I was at the cemetery and I was thinking to myself, after you go, there's nothing. There's no one there for you. No mother, no father, no brother, no sister, except for your deeds. Even your money is not going to be there for you. So the only thing that's going to be there for you is your good deeds. And that's the only thing that's going to help you gradually through your time from the grave until you get to your ultimate destination." Banat is a Muslim, and his renewed faith teaches him that he'll have to face his Lord one day, and his fate will be decided. Islam teaches that a person's destination can be heaven or hell, or sometime in hell and then in heaven. And much like other faiths like Judaism or Christianity, the goal is to please God and to be able to make it to heaven. Soon after his diagnosis, Banat took a trip to Africa. It was then he realized what his mission was. He decided to help the most needy people he met in a town in the West African country of Togo, and that he would build a shelter for widows and orphans, where people can have a safe place to live and food to eat, and kids could get an education. When Banat got back to Sydney, he says, "I got rid of all my cars, I got rid of my watches, even my clothes. I took them overseas and I gave them to a lot of people there. I wanted to try to leave this world without anything." Banat is still with us today. And let's pray that he stays with us for many years to come. Since his diagnosis just a couple years ago, he has set up a charity to help people in Togo, and his organization has already built wells, orphanages, a 10-acre cemetery, and has almost completed one of the main projects, which is called Village Project, where they're building 200 homes and orphanages, which will house 200 widows and 600 orphans, and a school for 1,000 students, with a medical center, to name just a few of the things that they're doing. And his charity goes beyond Togo. He recently raised $70,000 that he donated to Somalia's famine relief. Banath gives regular updates of his medical condition and progress on the organization's YouTube channel and Facebook channel. By the way, his organization is called MATW, in case you wanted to check it out. And in one of his latest videos he shot of himself a few months ago, I think it was from March 5th, he talks in a slow and almost slurred way. And he says that lately he's unable to eat because of the hole in his mouth that causes his food to come out of his nose. And he reminds people to thank God for the blessings that he's given us before they're taken away. You know, this story really got to me, especially when Banath was talking about how he felt at the cemetery, realizing that, you know, everything just goes. Your whole family will be gone. You will be alone. I mean, I am the type of person that gets scared being alone at night downstairs in my own home. But the thought of being alone in a grave is terrifying. But as a person of faith, I know that if I have lived a good life, and even taking Dr. Teo's points, a life being conscious of God and of helping others in need, I'm hopeful that my time after death will be peaceful and blissful. Thank you so much for joining us today. This will be our last episode before the summer break, but I do plan on staying in touch over the summer, so do look out for our posts. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please share it with others. And of course, please send us your comments and questions. By the way, I want to say to everyone who has messaged us, and mostly we get messages on our Facebook page, a huge thanks. I read all of them and I reply back as soon as I can. And it's a great honor that all of our messages so far that have come from our listeners have been positive. We can't thank you enough for listening and then taking the time to write to us. And it really motivates us to work harder to make a quality program. Until next time, I'm Lily Chaudhry. Please take care and have a great summer and take control.